Log Talk Radio.
Broken out my Chris Russo impersonation in a while yet. Good evening. Welcome to Blue Shirt Banner Radio. I'm Jim. With me, as always, Eddie. Good evening. How are you, buddy?
I am doing well. How is everybody doing tonight? Out there in Internet Radio Land.
Well, they're doing Jerky Boys in the chat room. Doing Saul Rosenberg. So, yes, I have my shoes and my glasses, so I have them. I went to see that other doctor, but he's an asshole. Anyway, good evening, everyone. Good to see all you guys. I am excited. James Patrick, number 3 in your programs, number 44 in 100 Ranger Greats, will be with us shortly. Really looking forward to talking to Jeep tonight, Eddie. How about you?
Oh, yeah. Big time. Big time excitement. Gotta say, so far, he is the... He may rival Adam Graves as far as being such a down-to-earth, cool human being. You take away the hockey stuff, this man is a quality human. I just noticed something. What the hell is going on here? Wow, I must have the wrong episode. I'm looking at our show, and it says we're on. It's from 7:30 to... Oh, this is an old... I'm sorry. This show is really old that I was on. The page I was on had, with the Nikolai Zverev move.
Nice. Nice. It's Eddie coming to you from the past.
I wonder why the chat room wasn't open for me. I was like, wow, the show must have... The show was...
Now, any minute now, Joe Flaherty's going to walk into the studio and hand me an envelope from Western Union that'll be from you in the past. And, you know, and anybody who hasn't seen Back to the Future won't get the joke. But anyway, Eddie's alive. Well, Eddie's alive.
So until I figure that out, so I'm with you. I'm with you here in the current. James Patrick is going to be here, and he's just a great guy. And I can't wait to talk about a lot of things. And me and Jim talked about it earlier, about talking to him about some things that perhaps no one is going to ask him, at least on MSG or anywhere else, because, you know, we want to know the scoop. And, you know, and it's going to be good, because I think James has got a good swath, or a swatch, if you will, about playing with Rangers over a long period of time under different coaches, pre-Messier, post-Messier, so we can get a whole, you know, the whole kit and caboodle, so to speak, from James. And I think he's really excited about talking to the Ranger fans, and he really, he sounded really excited about it. So I hope all goes well.
You know what's amazing? I don't even know if most people, well, I mean, probably your average hockey fan realizes it. He had over 20 years in the NHL. I mean, there aren't a whole lot of guys that do that anymore in this day and age. I mean, that's just that's incredible.
Oh. Yeah. I mean
he did 11 years with the Rangers. He did an 11-year sentence with the Rangers, and he was only halfway done. I mean, that's just amazing.
It is. And he really went from you know, an offensive guy who was known for his offense, a good power play guy, and really turned into a defensive defenseman and was one of the better ones and was a steady guy. You got to be – and he had a lot of injuries early on in his career that would make you think, you know, that he it wouldn't turn out to be a 20-year career, but he persevered And, you know, God bless it, as we say. So, so I'm looking forward to it. And,
yeah, me too.
Some things have happened on, I don't know, you know, some things have happened in Rangerland. Audie and Anisimov got hurt in the World Champions. He's having surgery, right?
Yeah, I read that today that he was having surgery, but I guess I didn't read the whole story. I'll be honest with you, I didn't have a lot of time today, but sounded like it didn't sound like it was anything major. We want to real quick, easy, Stan. Stan already fired up in the chat room. Before we get to James Patrick, real quick, I want to welcome in Mark Willoughby. He's from The View from 11. He's a Nashville Predators blogger, and he's organizing a special auction for the people that were affected by the floods down in Nashville. Mark, Jim, and Eddie, Blue Shirt Banner Radio, thanks for joining us for a couple of minutes here. How are you tonight?
Guys, thanks for having me on. I'm doing great. In fact, I'm just honored that you would have me on. Let some of your listeners know about what's going on down here next Monday night, June the 7th, here in Nashville.
Why don't you tell everybody a little bit about it? Because I'll be honest with you, I don't know a whole lot about it. I just know it's for a good cause. So why don't you let all our listeners know what's going on, what you're doing, and how they can find you?
Well, as a lot of your listeners probably know, May 1st and 2nd, the Nashville area received an unprecedented amount of rain, 18 inches in some spots within a 48-hour period, which led to flooding all across the Middle Tennessee area. Six blocks of downtown Nashville flooded, including the Bridgestone Arena where the Predators play. I have a picture of the Predators locker room with 4 feet of standing water from the Cumberland River that runs through downtown Nashville in the locker room area. Damage estimates for downtown Nashville and the residential areas that surround the downtown area right now, about $2.2 billion and still climbing. So what we decided to do was just gather up passionate NHL fans. The Predators have a passionate and growing fan base, and also fans of the game from around the country, and see if we couldn't raise the awareness of what was going on with this problem, and also in that process raise some money to distribute to flood victims. So we are holding an NHL tweet up on Monday the 7th. It is going to be at the Tin Roof here in downtown Nashville. For all of the folks that listen to this or listen to your podcast, come on out. It's from 6 to 9 o'clock. We have all of the coaches, the coaching staff of the Nashville Predators will be by. Pete Weber, our play-by-play man, is going to be there. We're going to have Tom Callahan, who does the play-by-play on radio for us. And we've got a number of silent auction items that will be auctioned. The Nashville Predators have just been great. They've given us signed jerseys, team autograph prints. They gave us a very nice Shea Weber, Ryan Suter autographed Olympic print.
Nice.
We've got other items that will be there, spa packages, autographed merchandise from country music stars. 100% of our proceeds are going to go to the Community Foundation of Middle Tennessee and their flood relief effort. I talked to Danny Muccio, who is the director of social media for the Islanders. Don't hate me for saying that, guys. And
I know Danny very well, since I knew Danny before she was addicted to Twitter. That's how far back I go with Danny.
Did you go back a long way? Danny is a great person, and shortly thereafter, after the flood, Danny called me.
She's a big fan of Eddie's work, too.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Well, Danny called me and said, hey, why don't we broaden the perspective a little bit, and let's see if we can't get the hockey community across America to participate. Long story short, she made some contacts with other teams, with folks that are her counterparts at other teams. And we've got an online auction through eBay for the Community Foundation of Middle Tennessee as well. Some of the items that are on there are a Rod Brenda Moore signed Carolina Hurricanes jersey. We have a stick signed by the New York Rangers. We have just got today, as a matter of fact, a puck, a Chicago Blackhawks puck, signed by Big Buff, Dustin Bufflin, who is obviously having a great playoff series here. The Ottawa Senators today just gave us a Mike Fisher and an autographed hat, an Alexei Kovalev signed jersey. We have just items that we're still plugging in. We are going to run the auction even after the tweet-up is over. 100% of those proceeds as well will go to the Community Foundation in Middle Tennessee, and those will be distributed to flood victims so that they are able to have the greatest impact, best bang for the buck with our dollars there. It's really been interesting, guys, the response that we have gotten from other teams. They've chipped in items for the auction, but we also got a $5,000 gift from the Columbus Blue Jacket Foundation, and also the owner's personal foundation matched that. So $10,000 came in from the Blue Jackets, the San Jose Sharks also did a fundraiser, and that money again going to flood victims. Guys, I got to tell you, it's just amazing. If you've never been flooded, it's incredible to see the amount of damage. Many homes that went underwater, many homes that had complete destruction of contents, carpet, personal effects, being gutted, trying to be rebuilt. It's just an amazing thing. It's going to take a long time for this area to recover. So the help, the support, the concern is greatly, greatly appreciated.
Now, Mark, how can they find this, your auction items on eBay if anybody wants to go bid?
If you want to go to the eBay auction site, go to my blog. The simplest way is go to my blog, which is www.theviewfrom111, just the numbers, .blogspot.com. If you go down about three posts, you'll see a post that I have saying that the online auction is live. You can click on that link, and it takes you directly to the eBay site. Otherwise, you can go onto eBay site if you want to do that. Search on the site for Community Foundation of Middle Tennessee, and it will take you to the Community Foundation site. There's a list of sellers there. You'll just click on the view from 111 to find the sports merchandise that we have. I will tell you, we've already sold a Vinny LeCavalier Tampa Bay Lightning puck, a Mike Green autographed baseball cap. So these items are starting, once we get them on there, the bids start to come in. We start to move them and get the proceeds in. So if you see something you like, I would encourage your listeners to go in and bid on it quickly.
I may get some bids in there.
I hope you will. We will be, and like I said, we'll be adding, just got the Big Buff puck today. We'll be adding the Mike Green hat. We'll add the Kovalev jersey tomorrow. I've got to get the pictures and get those inserted. And we'll have some other items coming in as well, so you need to check back periodically. They will be inserted in there, and the bidding starts. We really set the minimum bids on these pretty low just to get interest going and hope people will bid and raise money for this.
Well, Mark, we have a live chat that goes on during the show. I just posted the link to your website in there, and we'll also post it up on Blue Shirt Banner for you in the next couple of days, and we hope you raise a lot of money, and hopefully you can bring some kind of relief to the people that are affected down there.
Great. I sure appreciate this, guys. You know, I just have to tell you, as a fan in Nashville, I'm overwhelmed by the support, by the encouragement, just by the little things like this that mean so much to us as we start to get this area rebuilt. And, guys, I can't thank you enough, and I appreciate it.
Our pleasure, Mark.
No problem.
Mark, we'll talk to you again soon, and best of luck with everything.
Thanks, guys. Have a great evening.
All right. Take care. You too.
Have a good night.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, that was Mark Willoughby from the View from 111.blogspot.com, and he was talking about the auction that they're doing, and hopefully they'll be able to raise some money and bring some relief. So make sure you check it out. Like you said, they do have a Ranger item, and you guys in the chat room are we're trying to talk to this guy about a serious subject, and they're making jokes about what the Rangers donated, and I think it was Mario said that Sather just donated a cigar butt, and I'm trying not to laugh. You crazy, wacky pricks. Anyway, all right, we're going to have James Patrick here in a minute or two. Phone calls, we'll take phone calls after James Patrick. We may take one or two for him. We'll see how it goes. The number, you guys know it, 646-478-4692. We'll get to your calls later on. And we got some other stuff to talk about tonight. So, Eddie, do you want to get James on the phone? And
Or
you
want to
wait a couple of minutes?
There's a couple of things I want to address here. A couple people are in this chat room that I got a little bit of issue with, but of a goodly nature. Gucci Wally, alias Christopher, happy birthday, ladies and gentlemen, to Gucci Wally.
Oh, wait. Hold on. I didn't know it was his birthday. Wait a second. We got a little something here.
Oh, yeah, big time.
Hold on. Let's see what we got here. Feel like Willard Scott doing birthday announcements, and Mildred Feinstein from Passaic is 117 today. Happy birthday, Mildred.
And we have a special visitor, Cut a TML, whose real name is Jeff. Jeff is he's challenged Ranger Crisis by doing his own crisis show on YouTube called Leafs Crisis. And you know, I gotta say, you know, if I wasn't a Ranger fan, I'd be a Leafs fan. First of all, original six, they haven't had a lot of success in their long illustrious, you know, tenure in the NHL, and they have dedicated fans. So, I saw the first episode of Leaf Crisis, and I liked it, especially his imitation of me, which had my wife completely cracking up. So,
His video was good. If you haven't seen it, make sure you check it out.
Yeah, it's really funny. So, Jeff, thank you so much for that. And now we have bring up James, and we'll get this party underway, the Gucci Wally birthday party special.
Okay. All right, so while Eddie is getting James, you know, Jeff, you as a Leafs fan, you know, and if you're going to do this Leafs crisis, are you willing to go the extra mile like Eddie did? Are you willing to go to a Canadiens draft party and film it and make fun of it and get yourself in trouble? That's when you know you can compete with the man. You have to pull that kind of stunt to truly compete with the man that the founder of RangerCrisis.com. All right, so we're going to wait. Should be any minute now. We'll have Eddie back with James Patrick, and we'll talk to him for a while, and then we have some stuff to get to on the other side. We'll take your phone calls. Probably going to cut the podcast short tonight. I'm going to try and make it to the SB Nation Phoenix meetup, so I want to get out of here as soon as the show's over tonight. So, but we will try and squeeze in a few of your phone calls, and we'll talk about what's going on. Just going to wait a second here for Eddie to come back with James Patrick. And if you're waiting on hold to get on the air, you might want to hang up and call back in about probably about an hour or so. I don't want to leave you on hold forever. So, without further ado, let's welcome to the program the man who was number three on the blue line for the Rangers for 11 seasons, the one and only James Patrick. James, welcome to Blue Shirt Banner Radio. My name is Jim. How are you tonight?
Jim, I'm good. I'm excited to be here.
I'm glad to have you.
I haven't done a Ranger interview for a long time, so...
Well, get ready, James. It's going to be like, James Patrick, this is your life.
Let's talk about the Rangers more than anything else.
James, we're thrilled to have you, and I got to tell you that, you know, we've been fortunate enough to have some great guests on the show, and when the word got out that you were going to be with us, there were a lot of people that were just really excited that you're going to be here. Everybody remembers you well, and you're a fan favorite, so we're really glad you're here tonight.
Oh, that makes me feel good. I mean, I'm more than happy or pleased to be able to share some stories from the past. I certainly look back on my career. The best years I had were with the Rangers, and certainly as fun a time and the greatest city to play in of any of the places I played. So I'm happy. I'm excited to talk to you guys.
Well, I've been looking forward to this interview since we talked and at first, and I guess we could just start it off at the beginning and about the day you were being drafted. I asked this question to a lot of the guests we have. As a matter of fact, all of the guests. Do you remember where you were and when you heard the news? Because back when you were drafted, it wasn't such a big to-do that it is today. Could you share that with us?
Sure. I've been in the draft three times now as a coach with the Rangers or with the Sabres, sorry, on the management side, and I've watched it on TSN on the Canadian Sports Network here, for a number of years, probably the last 10 or 15 years, and it has become a huge event, and it's a huge event for the city hosting it, and in most cities they sell it out and get 18 to 20,000 people in the building, and it's a 2 or 3 day affair, so it has become huge. It was certainly not that way. I was drafted in 1981. Most of the first rounders did go. The draft back then was always held in Montreal, mm-hmm. and it was on a Wednesday. And most of the first round picks used to go to the draft back then. I guess different for me was I was playing Tier 2 junior. I wasn't playing Tier 1. I was in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. I didn't have an agent, and I was going to college. The next year, I was going to go to the University of North Dakota. So, I knew the draft was that morning, and I had a spare the first class, and I stayed at home as late as I could, and literally 15 minutes before I had to go to school, I got a phone call from a reporter telling me that I'd just been drafted by the Rangers, and I don't know who it was, a post. I spoke with him, and then he put Craig Patrick on the line, and I talked to Craig Patrick, who was the GM at the time. So I probably got 15 minutes to – I mean, I was numb the whole day. I was filled with excitement. But I ended up I remember I had a test that day, and I had to go to school. But it was – I mean, it was deep down. It was an incredibly amazing feeling, and it was something I hadn't accomplished anything yet, but it was certainly – I guess a step in the right direction, or the first door opening to my dream becoming fulfilled, which was to play in the NHL. I guess to back it up a bit, I there wasn't as much focus on the draft. There still was rankings, and I knew I was rated to go somewhere in the first round. I think later in the first round. So
right, yeah.
I had no idea. By what team or which teams were interested, but when I heard that it was the Rangers, I think it was neat because it was the original 16. I still have the picture at home. The first picture of me ever on a pair of skates was when I was 6 years old, and I was photographed at an outdoor rink wearing a New York Rangers jersey, and that was the jersey I wore my first year of hockey when I was 6 years old. So that was a pretty interesting coincidence. But it was, the awe of New York and the Rangers and the big city also went along with it. And it just, it was totally excitement for me.
And in that draft, there were, because I remember in the research that I was reading that they had predicted you to go like probably second round, late first round, and then you got picked by the Rangers. But in that draft, there's some crazy Hall of Famers in that draft. Dale Hawerchuk was taken first. Ron Francis, Grant Fuhr went right before you. Al McInnes, the 15th pick. That really it really did churn out some big time players in that draft. And
I think maybe all Hall of Famers, and maybe the best player in the draft might have been Chris Chelios, who went 40th.
Right.
Who was also playing. Playing in the Saskatchewan Junior League. I was playing in Prince Albert. He was playing in Moose Jaw. He was 2 years older. He was a 19-year-old playing Tier 2, and I think that probably was the reason he didn't get drafted as high. But he was, in my mind, the best player in the league, and I couldn't – I know I was a high pick, and I couldn't – I said, this guy is great. Like, I can't believe someone's not taking him real high, but Montreal picked it right by picking him in the second round. But I think that happens probably every draft. I remember Randy Moeller, I'm trying to think, Art Butcher, Jim Benning, Joe Cirella.
Right.
I think even Luke Robitaille might have been a late rounder and a late draft pick, like an eighth round or something like that, who also had a Hall of Fame career. But Bobby Carpenter, I think, went maybe fourth, somewhere in there.
So I think he was third overall. But, you're right about it. Tony Conte, there was a lot of good players came out of that draft. And I guess people wanted to know, you're originally from Winnipeg, right? How was that transition to New York? I know that sounds like kind of a, typical question, but it is. Now, we talked to Carrie Wilson about this, and Carrie's also from the Winnipeg area, and he wasn't able to find Madison Square Garden when he came to the Rangers. He actually had to be escorted by a policeman on a horseback, which I find, although he had been around the NHL, he went from Calgary to New York, what have you, and it was kind of an awe-inspiring thing. Is that something that you went through, or was it pretty easy?
No, I wouldn't. I think my first year, I think what made it easy was we stayed out in Rye, and it was a little quieter out there. I still remember the day I signed, I watched the Rangers play. I'm pretty sure it was Vancouver, and they lost badly. I was signing the next day, and they wanted, I had a hotel room. They wanted to keep it quiet. I was there with my agent, and he represented Peter McNabb, who was on Vancouver. And we went out to Studio 54 after the game. So my first day in New York, I went to a Ranger game and then went to Studio 54. Got to stand around and watch people. So talk about getting your eyes opened.
That's like a baptism by fire.
It really was.
And they shipped you off to Studio 54.
Yeah. And then to make matters worse, the next day we had practice. And I hadn't been on skates for about 2 weeks. And Herb Brooks introduced me to the team. And they told me we were going to have a real hard practice. It was a Monday. And always on Monday they had this hard practice. And I remember the skate, we had a normal practice and then a real hard skate at the end. And I remember doing laps and being a half, half the length of the ice behind all the other defensemen those are my early memories.
I want to know who took you out to Studio 54. Who were the culprits? Come on, we can name names.
Well, no, it was a player on the other team. It was Peter McNabb who had played in New Jersey but was playing in Vancouver, who's now a broadcaster with Colorado. Because I was at the game, but only Craig Patrick and Ranger management knew, and they didn't want anyone to know until the next day when they announced it.
Now,
so I wasn't around the team, but that was the first and only time I was there.
Okay, I would say his brother Max didn't he run the Capitals at one point? Maybe he was doing this to sabotage you right off the bat.
Ran the Devils,
yeah,
didn't he?
His father was GM of. And the Devils. But at the time, the Capitals.
Yeah.
That's right.
James, you said at your first practice you were half a step, you were behind all the defensemen. You're going to tell me that even Willie Huber was out skating you?
I'm telling you, I was at one end of the ice and they were at the other end of the ice when we were doing laps. That day Willie was out skating me, but it felt like it took me about 3 days to get up to speed again, but I honestly had not been on the ice. I finished the Olympics and it had been a long year, and the best thing thoughts from some close friends or advisors thought just stay off the ice. Then it looked like I wasn't going to get signed, maybe going to go back to college, so it's a little different now where I think training and everything is so regimented and you're more on top of it. But anyways, we had just finished the Olympics and traveled back from Sarajevo and went home for – ended up being about 2 weeks till I signed with the Rangers. So.
Wow. And how about your family? How do you – I know your dad, your dad's got a little bit of history as well. How did the family react to you becoming a professional? Turning pro and going to New York?
Well, I think it may be a funny, different evolution. Like growing up, my brother was always a superstar player from the age of 10 till junior. And I was in an average, even when I was 12, 13, 14, I certainly wasn't the best player on my team. And loved the game and it was my dream, but so I know there are seven kids in the family, five sisters, and everyone looked at my brother's going to be the more successful one in if you're having a chance to play in the NHL. So I think from 16 to 18 I grew and I advanced and improved a lot in my game, and so I think it was a shock to my family that I got drafted in the first round, and then 2 years later ended up turning pro. So it did happen quick, but I know my sisters were real proud and excited to have a brother in the NHL, and my dad had a professional football background. He played in the CFL for 13 years and in Canada, and he at this time had an insurance and real estate business, but I think coming from sports, he wasn't as caught up in it. He constantly preached education. Before I was drafted, he was the one who was really hoping that I would take the university route and go to school. He would have loved me to not turn pro and stayed in college. So I saw how other parents have reacted, and I've seen in the meantime, and certainly all parents have their kids' best interest. But I know my dad wasn't as caught up in the excitement or the glamour of having a son make it to the NHL. He was certainly proud of me, but
right.
I guess because
he was used to that. I mean, for the fans at home, your dad was an all-star football player with the Winnipeg Blue Bombers of the CFL. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
Right. For my own edification, like how big of a star was he? Was he like? Can you compare him to maybe a modern day NFL player?
I don't know. I do know at the time. I think the where the NFL was at the time and where the Canadian dollar's value was more, that I know that they attracted, they ended up getting a lot of big stars. I mean, they had guys who won the Heisman Trophy, played in the CFL, guys who were MVPs of the Rose Bowl, who were ended up being teammates of my father. And he played, his whole career was in Winnipeg. He was captain of the team for 8 years. They won four Grey Cups. They were, you know, I mean, the history of the Bombers have been around for almost 100 years. I think probably 85, 90 years now. And their best years were the years my father played. So he's certainly, he's kind of known as the glory days for their team. So, as a captain, and I know he was an all-star a number of years and all-Canadian, he certainly had a lot of recognition. Following his football career, he went into politics for 15 years. And he certainly was in the public eye and was used to that and experienced in those areas.
It's funny because, you know, looking back at it, explains it really to me, because it looked like kind of a circuitous route that you kind of took to get to the NHL. I mean, you're playing tier two juniors, and then you decide to go to college, and then now it kind of all makes sense to me. And we have one question already popped up. We have a chat room that goes on live while we do the show, and one person's asking. Was the hometown crowd in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, the best you ever experienced, James?
The hometown crowd?
Yeah, in Prince Albert.
I don't know if that's taken sarcastically.
It might be.
It might be, but I will say this. Obviously, I mean, in Canada, there's the Major Junior, which is Quebec, Ontario, and Western Hockey Leagues. Where a lot of NHL players come from, and Prince Albert is now in the Western Hockey League. They're a major junior team, but when I played there, they were by far the most dominant Tier 2 team in Canada. A lot of people consider them the wealthiest. They're building there. I know when I played, I think they've added on to it, and it's probably a little bigger. But when I played there, the building held 3,200 people.
Oh.
Every night there were 3,200 people in that building. It was sold, season tickets sold out, and standing room. I know some playoff games, they would cram them in there and almost get 4,000. So, for a young kid growing up playing minor hockey, when the only people at the games are your parents, that was my first exposure to people who paid it, had paid attendance to come and see a game. So, in a small building when there's 3,200 and it's jammed in there, it felt like 10,000 or 15,000 to me. And it was it's a small farming community who love their hockey, and that was the only game in town. So it was exciting in that building. It was a great year there. I played with Dave Tippett, who is now coach of Phoenix, but played in the NHL. He was also there. Greg Puzlowski played about 12 years in the NHL. From our Tier 2 team, I think ended up 8 guys getting drafted, and about five of them. It really is. And about 5 of them ended up playing sometime in the NHL. Probably Tippett, Puzlowski, and myself played the most, but some other guys played a year or two or played about 7-8 years in the minors and played some NHL games. So it was a great place to play junior. It really was.
But, it could be a sarcastic question by a Ranger fan. Let's face it. I mean.
It's certainly not Madison Square Garden, but for a prairie town, it was pretty good.
James, when you came to the Rangers and you signed, and then, you're talking about going to Studio 54 on your first day there, but who were the guys on the team was there anybody on the team that kind of took you under their wings, so to speak, and showed you, how to survive in the city, things like that? Who were the guys you ran with in your younger days, your first days with the team?
I think there's certainly a couple. I mean, there are some the young guys. Me and John Van Beesbrick were young guys together. I mean, just kind of the two youngest guys in the team, and we played together for 10 years. So I think I only played with them for less than half a year. But right off the bat, Dave Maloney was so good to me. And my arrival meant less ice time or no ice time for him because, you know, I'm 20 years old, but I don't understand it. I don't understand the ramifications. But looking back, I did, and he didn't play as much, and then he got traded the next year. But he was so good to me, and you know, I think he took me under his wing, helping me around the team and on the road. And then probably the two main guys, the two main vets who to me ran the team, were. Were Gresh and Tommy Laidlaw, and I think, you know, they gave me space when I first came, but, you know, by the end of that, you know, I came at the end of the year and the end of the playoffs and then the start of the next year, both helped me enormously. They became great friends and still are to this day. They used to make fun of me a lot, and I mean, just in camaraderie, you know, the team camaraderie. I think kind of those guys, and probably Nicky Cotillo, were the older players that really, really looked after me or tried to help me as much as any. I think they set the example for me that I tried to be when I became a veteran player to younger players.
I think Gresh is still running things as far as the old
guy
goes. He's like the Don over there. They all, he's organizing the card games and the gambling junkets and all that stuff.
He was made for that. And
he's one hell of a guy.
He really is. He's awesome.
I just want to ask, as a rookie with Fotiu on the team, were you ever a victim of one of his infamous pranks? We've heard a lot of stories about his pranks, and were you ever a victim? Did he ever get you?
Sure. I mean, maybe the second day there, he told me the phone was for me in the next room, and I had to go and get the phone, and he had Vaseline all over the mouthpiece and the earpiece, so when I put it next, you know, so that was like I think the first day. But I still have this image, and Nicky was constantly, like every day, we was trying to do something. But one, maybe my third or fourth day there, we had practice. And Nicky came in, and he was dressed in a red and white striped.
I know this story. Great. Go ahead.
And a button-up shirt I think it was like a Levi's button-up shirt, but it was red and white striped. And so, again, I'm new to the NHL. I'm not saying a word. And we go out and practice, and then we come off the ice, and there's a small little table, little card table in the middle of the room with Nicky's shirt spread out on the table and two sets of, like, a plate, two dinner settings, like a plate, knife and fork, and wine glass, and on top of Nicky's shirt. But the funny thing is the whole team came in and no one saw it at first and Nicky didn't see it. And now more, you know, guys are noticing it. And one by one, you know, guys are starting to laugh. And it looked like a scene from an Italian restaurant. It really did. That was the picture it looked like. Well, when we saw it.
He goes berserk.
Oh, he grabbed the table. He threw the table against the wall, grabbed his shirt. And then he looked at Gresh and started running at him and with his skates on. And Gresh just ran out of the room laughing his head off, and Nicky couldn't catch him. So, I mean, that image just stuck with me.
He said that...
It sticks to this day, so...
He said that he pinched Gresh's nose so bad when he finally caught up to him that he almost had Gresh to cry. That's a great story.
Yeah.
I love that story. And you were an eyewitness to it, which...
I was. I'll never forget it, so...
Nicky also tells a story about filling up Boston cream donuts with shaving cream, and Pierre LaRouche comes into the locker room and is like, oh, Boston cream, my favorite. takes a big bite out of it.
Yeah, I mean, every day Nicky would think of something new to do like that. I mean, it was, which is so awesome because it can be depressing and frustrating, and your confidence can be down, and nerves can be frayed. And even though the greatest game, you're playing a game for your living, but the pressures we ended up putting ourselves
right.
in under, and then. You know, for him to add that relief, it was awesome. It just made it a fun atmosphere to be around.
Right. So, I mean, you know, and now, you know, maybe just jumping ahead quickly to today, is it still that kind of like, you know, loose stuff going on in today's locker room, or is it more of a professional atmosphere? So
I don't know if it's as loose. I do know that, I mean, the guys like each other, and the guys love. I've seen good dressing rooms and not so good, and I do think, you know, if I'm talking about the Sabres dressing room, and I know the guys like being around each other. I know they like going for dinner together. They've been on the road and traveling and, you know, playing cards on the plane. There's sometimes with coaches you're going, I wish they liked playing a little more and you know, the stuff off the ice, you know, when you're thinking about a couple of players. But I don't know if they, I mean, the jokes and, you know, Nick used to switch keys. That was the other thing, you know, if three guys had the same cards, you know, guys would be in the dressing room, Nicky would sneak in the change room where the clothes were hung up, and he'd switch all the Toyota keys from one car to the other, or all the, you know, whatever I remember, like the Toyota Supra was a popular car, and a bunch of guys had trucks too. Like, I don't know if they're, you know, Ford trucks or Dodge trucks. And so then the guy couldn't, his car wouldn't start. And, you know, and then they, you know, the one guy couldn't leave the rail. But last and keys. So, I don't think that goes on today like it did in the past. So
even like just coming in as a rookie, like, you know, you were talking about the Vaseline and all that was a trick. But, you know, back in the day, and I don't know if it kind of ended when you came to league. It probably was still around with the whole the initiation and the what they would term hazing nowadays. You know, where they would dry shave you and do the whole thing, and was that around back then, or is that was kind of getting phased out?
It still happened. It happened to me and John Ambiesbrook.
Oh boy!
I think we were the two rookies. Bobby Brook was a rookie. I don't know if it happened to him as well, but of the three of us, I know me and Beezer got it. And I probably in the next. Over the next two or three years, it started getting phased out. I don't know. I think it was a tradition up to then, and
yeah.
You know, getting shaved and getting. I think that was the main. Yeah, that was more or less what happened. So,
yeah. I mean, you know, and I guess when the contract started getting all crazy, and I really couldn't afford to be like messing with, you know. I doubt Alex Ovechkin was shaved. Let's put it.
Yeah, I know exactly.
So,
or Sidney Crosby, or it's yeah, definitely. Well, obviously now the big thing is they have a rookie meal that gets almost out of hand, but they make the rookies buy dinner, and the bills, the tab can get very high.
So those first years now. I'm going to talk from a Rangers point of view and what the fan thought about James Patrick. And we got you. We're thinking, okay, guy is 6'2". He's a big guy. And then we find out you're more of an offensive guy now. There's been a Ranger fan stigma about guys who are taller. Willie Huber suffered, really. You know, didn't have a bad career here as a Ranger, but because he was a big dude and didn't throw the body as much as the fans kind of wanted him to, he kind of got labeled. This goes back to even before in the '60s with Harry Howell. Harry Howell, who was a great opera guy, you know, they used to say hit him with your purse, Harry, you know, and stuff like that. But then later you realize in retrospect that, you know, obviously Harry's got his number retired at MSG. He's an all-time great. And I think a little bit of that fell upon you later, especially, I think, well, before I get to that, you guys in 85 under Ted Sater, and which I know Jim is very curious about, is Ted Sater. Let's get to the Ted Sater era and that run you guys made to the Cup. You got knocked out in the semis, but because Wah played out of his head. I mean, you know. But maybe you could tell us a little bit about Ted Sater and that.
Well, I think Ted. Are you guys still there?
Yeah, we're here.
Oh, okay. I thought I might have lost you for a sec. I think Ted was a young coach, came in. I think he came in with some good intentions. I know he was maybe wanted to be a bit of a new age coach for that era. I mean, his practices were different. He certainly had the team prepared. Ted did some good things. He did some bad things. There are things I wouldn't agree with.
I don't want to cut you off, but I mean, he had a lot of Ranger fans PO'd because, number one, he sent down Pierre LaRouche. Which, when Pierre came back later in the season of playoffs, he was fantastic. I mean, it's like.
Exactly.
He kind of rocked the boat. I think Terry Kleisen just started that year in net.
Yeah.
And there's been talk that the reason that he started for the Rangers is because of that brawl you guys had in the preseason. And Kleisen just jumped, Roland Thompson or Kelly Rudy, one of those guys?
Yeah.
No, go ahead. I just wanted to throw that back.
Those are some of the things I was going to say. He wanted to put his stamp on the team. He wanted to get rid of some of the old guard. So at the point where the first cuts are made, he sent down Pierre, Mike Rogers, Nick Fatu, and Glenn Hanlon. And even if you wanted to make changes, no better teammate in the league than Glenn Hanlon. Oh. Even if you want, you know, Van Beesbrick is now going to be the number one, and you don't have a bona fide number two, you don't have anyone better than Glenn Hanlon. So that doesn't make sense, that move.
Mm-hmm.
I think Mike Rogers, the season before, had 70 points. The year before that was the leading scorer. And two seasons before, Pierre Rouge had 49 goals. The season before, mid-30s. So I'll even say if he so much even wanted to change the culture, you're going to get, in trade value, you're going to get something for those players of equal stature, and they didn't. And to finish it off, Nicky being like the, you know, certainly he was the enforcer at the time, but just such a good team guy. So I know a lot of coaches come in, they want to put their stamp on, they want to make changes. And so I didn't, and none of the veteran players appreciated the way those things were done. And it really shook up the dressing room. I don't think it put a lot of faith or trust in the coaching staff right off the bat. I think the other big problem is he came in with two assistants who had no NHL experience. None of the three had played the game, and I think you usually need someone on the staff who's played the game. Well, they didn't have that. They had two college coaches who the three of them were coming from such a different place that they were they just weren't. They didn't have the respect, and they didn't earn the respect. And it's tough, you know, it's tough to come in and try and command it. So that was how the season started. I think early in the season we lost Barry Beck, and probably was career ending, and that hurt the team. We got off to a tough start. One thing I will say about Ted is I think as the year went on, he was good at having us prepared. We, you know, back then teams weren't as much system orientated, and he had us. You know, as the year went on, we came better and better at playing our system.
Yeah, you guys went into it. I mean.
Yeah, we did. And then another thing about that season, I don't know if you remember, but Gresh was a healthy scratch for about the first five games. And even as a young defenseman, I thought, okay, I know Gresh is nearing, you know, he's closer to the end of his career than the beginning, but we all knew Gresh was still really strong on the puck.
Oh.
Great puck handler, great vision. No, he's a slow skater, but he just kept everyone to the outside and then was, you know,
right.
he didn't get beat on his on speed because he just was so smart positionally. But, you know, Ted, you know, I think he was another guy probably would have liked to move, but just wasn't playing him. Well, so at the first five games a year, you're not playing Gresh. At the end of the year, Gresh is our best player. He ended up with, I think, 25 goals, kind of split his time between defense and center.
Right.
And we lost him in the second round of the playoffs, and it was a huge loss. I mean, I think it was a loss that really hurt us going against Montreal because he was, at the time, playing center. He was big and strong, huge body who could handle the puck, and playing as good as anyone on the team. So I guess in credit to Ted, he realized the mistake he was making and eventually Gresh proved his way with his play. That's the thing I'm forgetting about. Pierre goes down to Hershey, scores 20 goals in like 23 games there, then comes up here and he ended up with 20 something in minors and over 21 in the NHL. So and was huge in the playoffs.
Yeah, big
so
time.
I don't know if Ted realized his mistakes or if Craig just kind of forced his hand and saying, that's it. You know, we can't score goals. We got a 50-goal score in the minors. He's coming back. And you force that move upon him. I do remember one of the assistant coaches coming into the dressing room one day and trying to tell Pierre Lourdes how to score a goal. It was in between periods. And he in front of the team, started to hear, like, if you do this, you know, you might have been able to score the goal on the goalie. And Pierre sat there listening to him, and then when he walked out, like, the whole room burst out laughing. So, again, you know, my memory is a little vague, but I remember that distinctly. So that kind of that epitomized some of the things that went on that year. But certainly, I will say this, as the second half went on, I think John Van Beesbrouck established himself as a top netminder in the league, and we kind of we played some pretty good hockey down the stretch, made the playoffs, and just rode him to the semifinals against Montreal. And we lost in we lost in five games, but every game was a one goal game. The overtime game that we lost, you know, it was 2-1 in the series, and we outshot them like 15-2, and they end up winning that game in overtime. And you know, the series it ends up being 3-1, and it could have been 2-2 real easy. So it was a closer series than in a five game would indicate.
Oh yeah, and I'm lucky to have all these games on video. So, and I gotta say the crowd at the Garden, Jim, you've heard it. You know, I've posted the video. How loud is that? I mean, it's rocking. I mean, it's, you know, the Garden, I think now, I don't know whether it's the acoustics or just the fact that it's still an exciting place to play. And when the crowd is, you know, come playoff time, you know, and the important games, rivalries, it's big time loud. But back then, it was so insane. At least maybe because I'm older and I think about it that way. But when I watched the video, right, Jim? I mean,
oh, yeah. And James, I was at the game in the playoffs against the Caps when Bob Brooks scored the late goal and then scored the goal in overtime, and you could feel the building shake, and the place was so loud. It was just unbelievable.
I I know there are some buildings like that. I think Chicago's like that right now, but I'm sure the Garden, the Ranger Garden, MSG can get like that in big moments in the playoffs, but it doesn't seem to happen as often. I know for a fact Buffalo is not like that, and they're blue collar crowd here, and they love the Sabres, but that crowd back then, I remember in those big moments was incredible, and maybe it was had more to do with there was definitely the blue seats up top, you know, and I know the boxes have taken away from a bit of that feeling, but that was incredible. Atmosphere.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even imagine playing in that. Sometimes I'll sit there and go, I mean, this is a question, I guess, to you, you know, as a player back then and then throughout your whole career. Do you get, like, in a zone where you just, the crowd is just not, you know, I guess it's the talent in itself
yeah.
to just tune out the crowd and be in the moment?
I think that moment, at certain moments, your nerves, if they're pressure moments or when you realize the importance of the situation, you know, a tie game late. I remember, you know, certainly as a young player, can you control your nerves? But once you would get used to the crowd, like you definitely could get into that zone where I found, if anything, certainly at home it pumps you up. On the road, you're just trying to focus, and you can get into a bit of a zone. When you get into those situations, I found that as far as affecting your play, it would just be on an individual basis of handling your nerves. I think your first time round, it's a new experience, and then. Once you've had it for, you know, once you've been a bit used to it, it's something that you can handle. And then I found at the end of my career, your nerves aren't as good as they are when you're like 24, 25.
Really? So you're not as fearless, I guess.
I found, it was different being the first playoff was a real, it was a great experience, but I just remember, putting some pressure on myself and trying to control my nerves, which was a bit of a challenge. I found as time went on, there's always the butterflies before playoff series, right? You know, the start, that first couple shifts. But then once you got into it, it was like just, you know, play the game, focus on what you have to do. But I also knew my last 4 or 5 years in Buffalo, you're thinking, geez, this is my last chance, or I might never get this situation. And if you get those thoughts in your head, they might add to the pressure. And I remember being fighting those at the end of my career.
Yeah, I'm just always trying the professional athletes. Mind, because you know me, forget about it. My knees would be wobbling, and I'd faint. That would be it. I hear one guy razz me in the crowd, and I'd be over. I'd be yelling at him, and they'd be saying, "This guy's not professional. Get him off the ice."
I do think it's harder to watch. It's harder to watch than to play. It really is. For most players, they get that release. They're releasing with the energy they can release the nerves. And I know as a coach, when you're standing there and it's a helpless feeling and it's almost the same nerves as a fan has. So it's almost tougher.
Right.
It's
tougher
on the fan.
Yeah.
It is. So.
James, I want to ask you, you went through the following season after that cup run. That was when, Espo fired Ted Sater, and then you had Tom Webster as a coach, and I think he had some ear issues, and then he stepped down, and then Espo, right, he couldn't fly, and then Espo took over. What is it like having been through that? You went through a couple of different coaching changes with the Rangers, and being an assistant coach yourself, what's the feeling in the locker room when a team goes through a coaching change? I mean, it has to be part of you that says, you know, I guess as players, we kind of failed the coach, but then in some cases, you're probably thinking, well, you know, good riddance to that idiot, and maybe now we can settle down and play hockey. What's the mindset that goes through you guys' mind when there's the changes like that?
I think it's different for every player. I think there's that number of players who feel partially or at large part responsible for the coach getting fired, and there are certain guys who could say, you know, exactly, good riddance. Said, good, it's about time we got rid of that idiot. And I'm talking. Even that, besides, I mean, every team, it seems, you know, there's 10 guys who like the coach or 8 guys who really like him, 8 don't, and then it's the guys in the middle.
Right.
But I'm saying even besides that, on, like, there are some guys who, you know, put more upon themselves and say, you know, if I could have done more, you know, that wouldn't have happened. I've been through a number of them, and it's never a fun place. It's never a... And sometimes I guess they're needed, but it's still when you think about the person involved and how it affects his life. And I mean, even I'll never forget Michel Bergeron getting fired. Got fired on April 1st and walked in 2 days before the playoffs. It was so shocking.
Yeah.
And I know there was issues. I know there was issues between him and Phil. But all I could think of was I remember seeing his daughter and his wife at games waiting for Michelle, and I didn't know them well, but got to know him to say hi. And I felt so bad for his little daughter, who was probably 8 or 9 years old at the time. That comes into play. But I know certainly that year after when Phil got the job, I don't think Phil, I think he was willing to give... give Ted a half a year to see how he started, but I don't think Phil was a fan of kind of the new wave of code that Ted was. And I'll say this: there is no, I don't know if I've met a more passionate guy about the game than Aspel. Love the game, and you know, he's an impulse buyer. He makes decisions, you know. He wanted to trade half the team after one game, and he loved the same guys the next game. And I certainly, but as far as enthusiasm and I mean, just wanted the guys to play and have fun. That was his message. So I mean, I loved Espo for that, but that year was an interesting year. I mean, Tom Webster coached for 10 days. 10 days, and then he couldn't coach more. So, you know, we had Ted, then Espo, then Tom Webster, and Espo, and
brought
Wayne Cashman in, and so it was, it was pretty unsettling.
Continuity was not Phil's strong point as a GM.
No.
It was exciting as a Ranger fan because when they weren't losing, for all his reactionaries, he would bring in these guys, the Brad Maxwell's. He would bring in not Brad Maxwell. He would bring in like Pat Price would come in, and like, oh, we got him. And Jeff Brubaker's on the team this week, and it was great.
Brad Maxwell did.
Oh, he did. Okay.
For a couple months.
So I was like, as a fan back then, you're like, oh, okay. Well, he wanted to fix the team so badly, and I guess he's just, and like you said, I mean, he's just so enthusiastic, and he's so blunt, which I love. He can't help but be blunt. I mean, that's just the way he is. He shoots right from the hip, and I love that about
him. I know. He's one of the greatest Rangers, and, I mean, he's, again, a Hall of Famer who loves the game, and I like him as a guy, too. Like, there's some guys who had some mean bones and went out of their way to be pricks. Excuse my language, but
no, don't
Phil
worry.
Was not that way at all.
Not on this show.
Yeah, Phil was
a prick? I want to know who was a prick, James. Name me. Somebody's listening. A couple thousand people only.
Yeah. I mean, you might have to be a coach at some point. You have to have a bit of that in you.
I'm
but
trying to guess work here.
Phil treated people good. Still, I mean, he had a great heart and treated people good. But it was interesting. There, some things happened that I can remember him and Michelle Bergeron arguing in front of the bus. We played a home and home with Pittsburgh, and we lost in Pittsburgh. We lost with a minute left or something late, and the plane landed, and we were having a bus take to back city. And in front of the whole team, they stood in front of the bus and argued for like 15 minutes. And so obviously they were having their different.
They needed an interpreter between those two guys.
Then on top of it, the whole team is going, who are they arguing about? Like, you know, it's someone on this bus that one of them wants to get rid of, and the other one is saying, one guy saying get rid of this guy, and the other saying I'm not, or, you know, and so, I mean, it was one of those ones where guys were yelling out trades being made, and, you know, I think Grash was, you know, saying, Willie, I think it's,
I think it's
you and and you're going to L.A. for Mark Hardy, or, you know, just yelling stuff like that out. It kind of broke the tension, but it's still things like that happened semi-regularly. So it wasn't, again, not always the best atmosphere for a hockey team.
James, did you have a problem understanding Michelle Bergeron on the bench? Because some ex-Rangers around that period that we've had on the show said they had no idea what he was saying half the time.
Yeah, but he said the same thing every game. I remember Michelle. Our team meeting was the exact same every game. Say who do these guys got? They got 1-2 player. They got the lousy goalie. We're gonna play 1-2-1-2-2, and we're gonna play hard. And let's go get them. That was the exact same talk. Our meeting was identical. I do know once he got in the heat of the game from who knows what he was yelling. He did yell Tabernak a lot, and emotional. I mean, he'd be jumping up and down that bench and running and down. And
Eddie, I think it was John O'Grodnick said he couldn't understand when we had him on.
He said he
couldn't understand
a word. He didn't know what his shift was.
Yeah, I know it's a little easier with defensemen. You know, there's only six of you, so if, you know,
right.
You usually know who's going next. But I think that's one thing I've learned from coaching is you got to make sure forwards know who's up next. And there's always confusion going on, so I'm sure for them it was tough. But we were in our own
John
world.
John would have been in Quebec too, so he had
he did.
He had a double.
That's right. Yeah. And I'm sure it was worse in Quebec because half the team was French.
Right. Exactly.
James, we want to fast forward just a little bit. You were there in 90-91, and then in 91-92, the big trade for Messier. What was it like the first time, you know, and you haven't been there almost 10 years at that point. What was it like the first time he walked into the locker room with you guys, and he'd already been given the C? And what was the mood about? You know, what was it like when he first came in there?
I think it was almost amazement. I remember Brian Leach saying to me after like the first day, he like just sitting on the bus, and he looked at me and he said, I cannot believe that we have Mark Messier on our team. And it was, again, sports was different. There was hardly any player moves, especially player moves in their prime. Now, I know Gretzky had been traded, but it was such a big, that was so unique because of, I guess, the money involved and those of where Pocklington's fortunes were, and that was different. I mean, obviously that was shocking.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there still wasn't, you know, a lot of players played most of their career with one team. And, I mean, unless you drafted guys like that, you know, or were lucky enough to, you know, finish near the bottom and get a real first or second pick, you didn't get you didn't have a chance at getting players like those. You know, Pittsburgh finishes last and gets Mario Lemieux. And here, you know, Mess is still only 30 years old and gets traded to our team. So I think we were in amazement. It was almost shocking, knowing that he was on our team. And I think when Mess came in, he was respectful to everyone and friendly and you know, kind of found his way. But, you know, right away on the ice, he showed, you know, what a great player he was. I think as he got more comfortable, you know, he started, being himself. And I've always said this, to me, the biggest strength of Mess as a leader was his confidence and his calmness. I think people think more about rah-rah and inspiring speeches or putting guys in their place. And to me, it wasn't so much that. It was just how confident he was and how he calmed the team down in tense situations. I think that and his confidence would rub off. Like, you know, we could be in a tense situation. We could be down a couple goals, and it was more like, relax, guys, relax. We're fine here, you know. And I remember one game, later once, he'd been around maybe the next year, but I remember one game he was -5. We lost like 6-0 to New Jersey. And, it didn't faze him outwardly. I mean, it might have bothered him, but he sure didn't let on, and he was as confident as can be. And, like, the next night he went out and I think he had, like, 4 points, and we won. You know, we had a big win. I think that was one of his greatest strengths, besides the talent and how good a player he was. But it brought a build-up to it. That was the other thing. I don't know if he had held out. I don't know the situation, but it was like we played one game. I remember we played in Boston, and we were on, like, right after the game, I think, is when it was happening. We were flying to Montreal because we were going to practice there and then play. Maybe we started the season Thursday in Boston, and we were playing Saturday night in Montreal. But it happened after the game, and because it happened so quick, it was shocking for the team.
Yeah. He ushers in a new era, or, you know, his era. I guess when he won the cup without Gretzky, that even, improved his cred even more. I mean, you know, as the guy. And it really did change. I mean, that year under Roger Nielsen, you guys win the division. I think you might have won the President's Trophy that year.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, talking about a team that, it's incredible, the transformation that happened. And a lot of it must have been due to Roger. And maybe you could tell the fans out there a little bit about Roger Nielsen, the late Roger Nielsen, and what kind of coach he was. We know we used to call him Captain Video and this and that. What kind of demeanor did Roger have?
Phenomenal demeanor, and so different than what I expected. We hired Roger as a coach sometime over the summer when Neil became general manager. And I'd heard about the Captain Video, and I knew he was an older coach, and I had an impression he'd be like an older kind of, like, you know, stodgier, like kind of grumpy guy. That was my impression of the Roger Nielsen you saw on TV. And maybe a week before training camp, we were skating at Rye Playland, or showed up at the rink, and Roger walked through wearing beach shorts, a T-shirt, flip-flops, and he had his dog walking beside him, and he looked like he'd been, you know, suntanning on the beach all summer. And we walked into the lounge at our practice rink in Rye, and MTV was on, and there was a music video, and I mean, we were introduced to him, and then he started talking about this video being his favorite video. And, I mean, it was the
music video.
I still remember it was Sinead O'Connor. Nothing compared to you.
And oh yeah, Roger, the Flint song. Yeah, the Flint song.
Yeah, exactly. And it was so different. My initial from what I thought, and Roger, I mean Roger loved nature. He loved hanging out. He loved ride because it was on the water and right next to a beach. He loved, you know, he would ride his bike or he would sleep at the rink. But as I, you know, ended up playing, I think 3.5 years for him. I will say he was one of my favorite coaches. I think he had our team as prepared or more prepared than any coach. What I liked about him was I felt finally we have a coach who, and it was what I liked was we were on the same page. This is what we did when we lost the faceoff in our zone. This is what we did when we, you know, we do this if we lose it, we do this if we win it.
Right.
Same with the neutral zone, same as the offensive zone. You know, we had a system of what we're going to work deck, and this is how we're going to kill penalties. And so I just really enjoyed that. He never yelled. He was, the extent of him getting mad was going, for crap's sake, you know, and he raised his voice a little bit, but, you know, he never swore. And
he got like the Beaver dad mad.
Yeah, he well, in some ways, but he was his own man because he was different. Mm-hmm. But he, as far as the video went, you know, again, then you're wondering, man, are we going to be watching video all the time? I've never had a coach who had better video because it was edited so much or so well that after a game that, you know, if we practice the next day, we would have about, I would say, maybe 5 minutes of video, and it was so edited. We'd maybe go over if there were some breakdowns or some obvious or glaring mistakes that kind of needed fixed. You know, he'd go over them, and it would be in a positive way. He'd say, you know, this is how we play our system, so we don't do this, and, you know, I'd rather do this. And then he would show the good plays, or he'd go through the goals that we scored and, again, be positive about them. So, I mean, it wasn't like we were there watching, you know, a half hour or an hour video. And then on the day of a game, we'd have a meeting before our morning skate, and he'd have the other team's general tendencies. Then he'd show their power play, you know, a minute, 2 minutes on their power play, 2 minutes on their penalty killing, and that would be it. You know, it'd probably, again, be probably 7 minutes long. And I found it extremely beneficial. So, anyway, so I enjoyed playing for him. I know, you know, he had us playing one system, and so, you know, I think after a couple of years, some players felt we played a little too defensive. But I always thought, you know, he kind of gave, you know, Messier, Leach, Monty, and, you know, maybe the top line, he gave them free rein. But then, you know, the rest of the team, he wanted to play a little more structured game. So, that team was maybe the best team I ever played on. And we were, you know, 3 minutes from having a 3-1 lead on Pittsburgh. And, obviously you can always say could have, come over, but that team was very close to maybe going all the way.
Yeah, I mean, Roger really, I tell you, when he came to the Rangers, everybody was like, you know, he wasn't a high-profile guy, let's say, you know. I mean,
yeah.
In hockey annals and circles, he was. Everybody knew the guy knew his, you know, he knew his stuff, you know. But he certainly proved, and the Rangers actually had some of the tougher teams under him. Actually, didn't Lindy Ruff, was on that team, I think, too, right?
Yeah, Roger brought Lindy in.
Yeah.
We had Chris King, who Roger brought in, obviously Ty and Joey Kosher. And, we're all guys brought in under Roger. Roger, like, he wanted his teams to be physical. You know, he wanted, he liked to have the physical players to back up the skilled players and to have to be very, very structured for the time as far as preparation. So,
Now, I know you work closely with Lindy Ruff. Does Lindy remember his penalty shot goal at Madison Square Garden? Does he talk about that?
All the time.
Get out of here.
We never hear the end of that thing.
Against Mario Brunetta,
who
of the Quebec Nordiques. I was at that game.
He took a flat shot, didn't he?
Oh, let me tell you something. Everybody in the crowd was like, no way this guy's making it. And then he did it, and we were just going crazy. Couldn't believe it. It was, I don't know. So he still talks about that, huh?
Oh, sure. Yeah, whenever.
I would too. I mean, let's face it.
Whenever players are taking penalty shots at the end of practice or working on penalty shots or breakaways, if someone ever yaps at him, sometimes the coach will give it a try. He always has a comeback. How many goals did you score in a penalty shot in a game? And then we have to. Then we hear the play-by-play on what happened with it. So right. I've heard a few times.
I want to throw some names at you, and just give me a quick synopsis or a little quip about these guys. Milo Horshava, you remember him?
Sure do. He was Michel Bergeron's whipping boy. He was
Ranger fans' whipping boy too.
Well, he was number six.
He was a skilled player though. He was a good player who never got on the ice, and he would make a little mistake, and then Brady would be all over him. But I remember at one point we had some injuries, and he came through. He really played well, maybe for a couple games until the injuries came back. But I think he was a skilled player.
Oh, yeah. The Rangers went through a lot of – this is just, again, the Ranger fans' point of view. I know you know a lot of – but the number six had a lot of problems for the Rangers for a long while. It may still have today. We don't know. But we had guys like Bruce Bell. You remember Bruce Bell, right?
Sure, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's just a lot of
Jim
guys.
Jim Weimer? You remember Jim Weimer?
Jim Weimer, yep. Jim Oscar Meyer, we used to call him.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was one of those guys. And Troy Millett, who wound up going to Edmonton. Troy was, Bernie Nichols likes to was it Bernie Nichols? Bernie Nichols likes to take credit for Troy's big goal totals that one year. I think when Roger coached him.
I know Roger brought him in, and I thought Troy would have a longer career, but he was tough and he could skate, like pretty fast skater and tough. I don't know. I know he had a big year, and it was probably his second, third year. You know, he ended up, I don't know how many goals he scored.
It was 19, 305 penalty minutes.
I know. I just think, he's one of those players. He had little early success and maybe thought it might happen, and you can never stop working with it. I do think he could have been a fourth line, physical player who could really take the body, but I don't know if he had the hockey sense to be a top six forward.
Mm.
I know after his early success, they thought he might be a power forward in the league.
Here's one for maybe you can give us some insight on this if you don't mind. Jeff Blumberg. Now, Jeff Blumberg, and I know you know this incident well.
Sure, yeah.
You know what I'm going to talk about? The Islander Vakota and Baumgartner attack him. And I believe Jeff was a born-again Christian at that time, but I had heard in the minors he was somewhat of a brawler. Now, I don't know if that's true, but do you remember that incident and what was going through your head and, how you felt?
I remember the hit on LaFontaine. Clearly. And my recollection of it was there's a minute left in game one of the playoffs. We're leading 2-1, and the puck gets thrown off the glass past our left defenseman, and, LaFontaine, who's kind of coming up the middle full speed, gets to the puck. I think Mark Hardy is the left defenseman who's chasing him. But I had I had him cut off. Like, I remember, you know, kind of seeing this is going to happen, puck coming out, and I had good speed coming back, but I just my angle, I had him cut off. Like, he couldn't. I knew his only play would kind of be to keep going wide, and, you know, and I was going to trap him, you know, maybe by the corner, but he thought he could cut in. And with a minute left in the game, my mind is thinking, I'm going to go and run this guy as hard as I can.
Right.
You know,
you are
when you're preserving the
lead.
But even if I was, you're not going to do it in that situation at that time. You know, there's a minute left, and I'm going full speed, but I've got him cut off. There is no room for him to cut in. And he decides to try and cut in, and my only option was just to put my shoulder down. But because I had so much momentum coming, I mean, I still remember the feeling of hitting him was like a knife going through butter. Like, I mean, you hit that golf ball, like, right on the nails.
Right on the sweet.
So I knew I caught him with my, you know, my shoulder, you know, right, you know, high in his, whether it was his head or near, you know, his midsection, and really gave him a jolt, and he went straight down. And obviously we got the puck and went down to their end. So, I mean, bang, I knew I hit him. I knew it was a clean hit, and nothing happened, and as the play ended in their zone, I mean, I knew their bench was going crazy and yelling, and I could feel the adrenaline. Like, I remember my adrenaline is going, and I'm going, oh, boy, here we go, you know, and it's like, you know, it's that, you know, fight or flight tendency. I mean, get ready, here it comes, you know, we're in a battle now, that kind of mentality,
right.
Thought. So, anyways, I don't know if there was a timeout called, but we get ready for the face-off, and I'm on the ice. And I still remember the refs are, you know, they're getting close to dropping the puck. I'm lined up, and then all of a sudden, you know, I hear guys yelling from my bench. I turn around, and Roger calls me off the ice, and he sends Jeff on the ice for me. And I guess probably noticing that they had put on, you know, Baumgartner and Vakota and Pilon and you know, more of their fighters. And then, you know, the second the pucks dropped, they didn't even play the puck. All five guys just dropped the gloves. And, yeah, they went after, I mean, I guess Bloomberg, who took my place, I remember at one point it was like two guys were on them, and then everyone got in there, and both the goalies were messed up or mixed up together. And I remember Chris King, I think we had King, maybe King, Broughton, and Turcotte might have been our checking line that was on the ice. But,
yeah, and that's... I never understood that. I remember J.D. was announcing the game, was absolutely livid. He said, I remember it. He was like, you know, I have all the utmost respect for Al, but what he did tonight was a disgrace. That hit that you laid off on Tane, in 1990 there was a sports paper called The National, and it made the front page of The National, and I had that picture of LaFontaine sprawled out there on my refrigerator for a good 8 years. You know, listen, I'm a Ranger fan. I'm loving it.
Yeah.
And Pat, who we've had on the show,
yeah,
he is one of the all time great guys. I mean,
yeah, he is. He really,
and,
I mean,
go ahead, Jim.
I feel bad that that he got injured on the play. I feel bad that I'm sure it contributed because he later had concussion issues, and that was probably his first one. And he was, you know, a Hall of Fame player, so I don't take any pride at all in that. I can live with the fact that it was a good play. I know it was the right play, a good hockey play. So unfortunately, he got hurt on it.
Right. And so now the fans in the chat room are going crazy, and they really want to know. Now, we alluded to maybe some coaches that you might be considered pricks.
Yeah.
And I guess we're going to have to ask the question, what was up Mike Keenan's butt about James Patrick? You have the 87 Canada Cup where you basically ride the pine because Iron Mike decides he doesn't like James Patrick for whatever reason. The 94 trade, which, I mean, it just... the Rangers got Steve Warmer out of the deal, which was a key component in my mind of winning a three-way deal. But
what's the deal? Let's talk plainly. I mean, we could talk nicely, but what was the deal between you and Mike Keenan, or just Mike Keenan and you?
I don't know. It might have been me. It might have been just me. I do know, like a lot of coaches, and I do know Mike in the past, when he goes to a new place, he wants to establish his culture and his identity. I had been with the team the longest after, I know, Beezer had left that summer. That was the summer Beezer had been put on waivers or taken in the expansion draft, I should say, and us being the longest serving members of the team. So I think that had something to do with it. I do know...
But, James, going back to the 87 Canada Cup, you know,
yeah.
We're all excited that you're in it, I mean, as Ranger
yeah.
fans, and we're reading in the newspaper you're not playing. I mean, you know, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but I do in a way because there's no way else, other way we're ever going to find out. I mean, it's not like I'm going to get Mike Keenan on this show.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is it just like – because you seem – and let me just see if I can figure this out. You seem like a really – down-to-earth, nice guy, just a great human being. You know, I mean, you know, I'm not trying to flatter you. Listen, we're all
yeah.
great human beings. But the thing is, except some of these people in the chat room, they're a little shady. But was it just like the fact that he was supposed to be, you know, this fiery persona, this taskmaster, and he didn't like... I don't know. I'm trying to figure it out. I wasn't there. Do you think maybe that had something to do with it?
I mean, it certainly could have. I mean, I do know, and I will say, like, it's as far as the Canada Cup, like, I felt I played, I didn't play the first game, but I played the rest of the games, and I played, somewhat regular, or, you know, got a regular shift until the finals against Russia, and then it was like, one shift a period or like three a game.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, he certainly didn't use me there. But I guess going back to, I don't know what happened. I do know, I mean, there were some other players who didn't play, and I think, I even look at a guy like Eddie Olczyk, who before that year was a regular player, and then, you know, he played the whole year, but he didn't play regular.
Right.
I think, you know, Mike's a guy who shortens his bench. He'll go with three defensemen and have everyone sitting, and he'll go with two lines and he'll, you know, if it works, he'll do that and he'll get some results. But I do know, obviously I knew him from the Canada Cup. He coached me. I mean, if someone
right.
You know, I would say hello to or talk to you. Came in again just a day or two before training camp, had been skating and saw him at the rink and said hello, shook his hand, and that was it. He said hello and we never had a conversation, never said anything else, and I thought that's somewhat strange. We ended up playing, I'm pretty sure we played 11 exhibition games that year, 11 or 12, because I remember we went to London and played
in
Wembley Arena.
You won that trophy there.
Yeah, that's right.
We were like,
Prince's Mustard Cup.
Yeah, we were like, that was
yeah.
our cup. We would thought, and then it actually turned out.
That's right. But I only played three of the exhibition games. It was probably a telling tale. I probably should have, found out why, you know, and which is more apt to happen nowadays. But, I thought, geez, they're looking at a lot of different guys, and I'm not playing.
Right.
And then the first game of the year, I was dressed, and Brian Leach started. Brian Leach and Bukaboom started, and then. And then it was, I'm trying to think who the other defenseman was. I'm pretty sure it was...
Rapotsev, maybe?
No, it was Zubov and maybe Karpatsov, and then me and Kevin Lowe. And so Leach and Bukaboom went on. Zubov and Karpatsov went on. And they were getting near the end of their shift, and I stood up getting ready to go on. And not many coaches handle both the defensive forwards, but Mike does or did back then. And he walked down to me, and he said, "What are you doing?" This is why, and the game's going on. I go, "What do you mean?" He goes, and then with a bit different language, he said, "Sit down. You're not going on the ice. You'll go on when I tell you to go on." There's a few other adjectives thrown in there.
Ah.
That was basically the first thing he said to me all training camp, like through training camp, and this was the first game of the regular season. I ended up playing three shifts of the game, the whole game. We lost the game, and the next day we didn't have a practice. Every player had a five-minute meeting with the coaches. And in my meeting, Mike told me I was the worst player on the ice the night before. I said, "Mike, I play three shifts. That's impossible." And I said, I never made a mistake in those three shifts. But he went on to say, "Listen, if you don't play better, you're not going to be here." And I said, "Well, I can't play any better if I don't play more." And it was kind of that type of discussion.
Right.
So that went on, I think, for five more games. I remember sitting out some, and then I was a healthy scratch maybe for 5-6 games before I got traded. There weren't words expressed between us. There wasn't a fight.
I mean, the lack of a better term, he had a hair up his ass about you. I don't know why. Listen, we're glad that Mike Keenan coached the Rangers to a Stanley Cup. We'll forever be in debt for that. But no, Mike has not really done too well. He's been, and it's funny, one of the posters here on one of the boards says they wanted me to ask you the question, which I already asked. It's basically, does James still have a Mike Keenan voodoo doll, and does he stick needles in the eyes of it? Keenan always picked the player to trade or banish when he joined a team. Jeep was that player. So maybe that was the case. I don't
know. I remember talking before to Troy Murray, and I know the same thing happened to him in Chicago. Got rid of him. And Troy had been there for a long time. And Troy was a good player. And so I think, it certainly worked for him. They ended up winning the cup, and he was... They made another number of changes, Mike Gartner, Tony Monty, myself, and from the, obviously from the year before. So,
who was pissed more about being traded, you or Darren Turcotte?
I forgot me and Turk were traded together. That's right. I will say this, probably after about the third or fourth game, I ended up having a talk with Neil Smith, I met him in the press box at one of the games, and Neil was awesome. And Neil said, "You know what? I knew this was going to happen to some players, and I feel bad that it's happening to you." And he says, "Look, I'm going to do everything I can to see if I can move." So this was after about three or four games. So I knew
it was coming then.
I knew it was coming. I'm a big boy. I can live with it. I look at it as it's meant to be. I have no problems with that. I would have loved to have won a cup, and I didn't. Came close to 1 year at Buffalo, but still was able to at least go on and continue my career and play. So that was, came out of it.
I mean, the map of your life, I don't want to get too philosophical. I mean, it's been written, and this is just the way, and then everything turned out for the best. I mean, all right, got a Stanley Cup. You got a lot. You're blessed with other things. I'm trying to make lemonade out of lemons.
I hear you.
James, before we let you go, Blue Shirt Banner is part of the SB Nation network. We're the, obviously we're the Rangers community, and one of our writers from the Buffalo Sabres site, which is diebytheblade.com. We invited them to come on, maybe ask you a couple of questions about the Sabres, if that's okay. So we want to welcome to the program.
Sure.
He's been holding for a long time, Zach Zelanka. Do I have your last name right?
You do. Thank you very much.
Zach, welcome to the program. Jim and Eddie, and you've got James Patrick. Thank you very much for waiting.
Hey, thank you guys for having me. And James, I really only have one question, and that is, with the way this season has gone, or the last season has gone for the Buffalo Sabres, how much expectation do you guys have for next season, and what are you guys looking to do, or what plans are you guys making going forward to possibly make this team a little bit better? And
well, yeah, I mean, that's, I think I fully expect us to build off of this year and be better. I do think our core players are coming in. They are in their prime, obviously, with a goalie like Ryan at the stage he is in his career. I know where he is. He gives us a chance, an opportunity to win every time he plays. I felt that, and I think the coaching staff feel that there was a lot of positive strides made this year, but because of the way the playoffs finished, it can leave a pretty bad taste in your mouth at times, and you don't want to have that wipe out a lot of the gains that were made, and we were disappointed with the results. We're disappointed with some of the play of some of the guys on the team. And yet, even under those circumstances, it still went six games, and they were every game was a one-goal game, and two of those games that we lost, we had two-goal leads. So, we felt, it was a close, real close series. We felt down the middle, Boston was stronger than us. And I know I played with Tim Connolly, and I've also coached him, and I will say this. He was injured for 2 weeks coming into the playoffs. He had one practice, and he had told us, we've talked about it numerous times, he never felt worse on the ice than any of the games that he played. He just felt he couldn't get his legs. And actually, we thought Derek Roy played well up until the final game. He didn't pick a good game to have a bad game, and that was in game six, but other than that, he was still one of our top forwards. But when you look at the series, Bergeron and Krejci outplayed our centers and Sobotka as well, and their special teams were better than ours, and that was the difference. So still, what are we doing now? I guess I can only speak for the coaching staff. We're in constant contact with our players with an emphasis on the younger players. We're still sending them teaching clips. We're asking them, what can we do to help you to make you better for next year? And we're sending out emails about positive reminders and just trying to guide them through their off-season programs as far as their strength and conditioning. And some guys are using skating coaches and skill coaches. And so we're having a little input with that. As far as the changes, that's definitely more Darcy's area. I know he confers with Lindy on that, but I couldn't tell you whether what's going to happen. Obviously, we have some unrestricted free agents. I don't know if they'll be back.
Tony,
I think Ludman and Talander, and yeah. Talander had a great year, and I mean he's a. He's a dominant defender. I don't know if dominant is the right word. He's a. I think he's a very good defensive defenseman in this league. He's one of the top skating defensemen. So it's hard to come by players like that. And hopefully he's going to be back. I don't know. And I think every year there's changes. I expect there'll be some changes with our team. And I don't know if there are changes in the way of top six type of players or guys on the bottom lines or lower lines. So we'll see. I know those things are being discussed, and But again, that'll come usually. I mean, things might happen around the draft, or that's when a lot of activity seems to happen in the league. But I honestly can't tell you because I'm not involved in those discussions.
Yeah, I mean, you got to look how the draft shakes out, and then your trading deadline, and the UFAs, and the, I mean, you know, it's a whole new ball game, you know.
Yeah.
So, but
you throw in the salary cap, which
right.
has to be managed, and I know it's a mandate from our owners to be fiscally responsible, and we have a.
You got one of those?
Yeah, we do. We have a self-imposed.
Yeah, we need one of those.
Yeah, so we have a self-imposed cap, and that determines what happens, and it's so much more prevalent now than.
Well, James, I just want to just to give you where the Ranger fan is right now. We're at our wit's end. I mean, I'm not going to ask you to comment on it, but between James Dolan, the absentee landlord. And and Sather, who, listen, he's got a great track record, but yesterday or the day before was his 10-year anniversary as GM, and it's just not getting done. That's all I'm going to say on that.
Well, you know, I will say this, though. If you notice today, the ex-assistant general manager of the Rangers was named general manager of the year.
Yes, Don Malone.
And I know when he came on board with the Rangers, he did a great job with the farm team and a real good job with developing and drafting and bringing in a lot of young talent. Guys who were on the team, whether, you know, Girardis and Callahan's, and I mean, numerous players, I think he had a big hand in the team. So
I mean, Don Maloney, even with the Islanders, did very well. It was just Mike Perry traded them all away.
That's right. So, but anyway, but saying that, I will say, you look how quick teams, I think teams can turn it around quicker than ever. You look at Colorado, it's a young man's game. And I think because of how good young players are nowadays that, the teams can turn it around real quick. And so, I mean, that certainly applies. I mean, they have to look how close it is. Look at Philly. Look, I mean, every team out there has to say Philly was a shootout from not making a playoff.
James,
now
tell them
the
that
final.
Story you told me about the shootout and when you were supposed to address the team on the day of last day of the season.
The day of the shootout, we were playing New Jersey, and theirs was an afternoon game, ours was a 5 o'clock game. And I know I can say this on Ranger radio.
Yeah.
I being a Ranger, I will never ever cheer from any team from Philadelphia. And I mean, I don't want to use the word hate, but I, you know, you really develop that hatred for the Flyers if you play for the Rangers, especially during the time I did. I don't know. Do I want the Rangers to make the playoffs? And this is like in the last couple of weeks of the season, you wonder who you're going to end up playing. And, mm-hmm. and then it came down between the two of them. And we went out for dinner the first game, and I'm watching the game. I can't watch any game without cheering for someone. And I'm watching, and I want the Rangers to win so bad, you know, the first game against Philly. And now they go into Philly here, and I'm just, you know, and we're playing. So we watched a bit of the game before, and then we came off, during intermission. I think, I'm trying to think what intermission, whether it's between I think it was between the first and second. But sure enough, they started the shootout. And the clock for our game is winding down, and we have to go in to talk to the players. Well, I let Lindy and the other coach go in the dressing room. I stayed in the coach's office, and I watched the whole shootout. And I wanted the Rangers to win it like they were the Buffalo Sabres now. Like I was their big fan, and I was so disappointed when I did not like the last move.
Holy Okun, no way, no way, Jose, James. And I don't.
I didn't like that as a fan of.
Oh
player,
my
so
God!
Bug me,
feeling,
but I was pulling for the Rangers. I got to tell you that. So.
Well, the problem with that, just to go quickly, is all right. Ole, he went with the percentages, the shootout, blah blah blah. When you got a Marion Gaborik on the bench, I don't care what the stats say. And to me, maybe you'll agree with this or not, but Ole Jokinen's career as a Ranger is in the balance, all right? He's probably not going to be back this year. I want that guy to take that final shot who's going to be with the Rangers, who's Brandon Dubinsky. No, well, not Brandon Dubinsky, but, you know, like somebody's going to be here next year. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It really wants us to do it, and we were distraught for weeks over that. Ole Jokinen, that's what they're calling him.
I won't go that far. I just didn't like the move. I mean, I know he scored goals in this league. I know he scored in shootouts. I don't know how successful that move is. I doubt. Maybe the numbers will prove me wrong, because I've seen guys try it. But that last little, you know, come with speed and that little fake between the legs, I've seen it not work a lot more than it does, and it just go with something. I mean, a quick deke and rifle it, or just rifle it. I mean, at least you're putting everything into it, I think. So
yeah,
I didn't like the choice.
Yeah, and like you said, I mean, that's the difference. I mean, the Flyers are in the Cup. See, the game is 2-2 right now. Is my last update on that. And I just wanted to hit a couple points before we let you go. I mean, I can't believe we've done almost an hour and 45 minutes, and I still haven't gotten to a lot of stuff. But I began to say it earlier in the show about where James Patrick was, like on the Ranger fan view. When you – that 85 series when against Montreal, you didn't have a great playoff. I don't know. Maybe that was because, you know, you're a little wet behind the ears. It was early in your career. But then later on, you come out and Brian Leetch gets hurt. What was this, like 89 or 90? Was it 90? When you guys lost?
I'm not sure. Around that time, I'm not sure.
Right. And you step up and you go crazy. You know, you have a great playoff. And I think that's when Ranger fans – and Jim, when we look back at the stats, you put on some sick numbers. Sick numbers. I mean, you know. 14 goals, 40 assists. I mean, you know, these are, I mean, fantastic numbers back in the day. And speaking of which, I don't know if you know this, but there's a book out called 100 Ranger Greats. Are you aware of this?
I've never seen it. Maybe I think it was in the playoffs in Boston. One of a fan outside the hotel was collecting autographs and asked me if I'd seen it. So that was the first I've heard of it.
We're
I'm in the book somewhere.
You are in the book, and we're good friends with the authors and the late John Halligan, who was on the show, and Russ Cohen and Adam Rader. And I love this book. I mean, I could dispute some stuff in here, but that's what it's about. Number 44, James, that's pretty damn good for an original six team. Guy from Winnipeg, I mean, that's unbelievable. Number 44, I'm looking at it right now. You're right behind some guy named Butch Keeling, a goaltender, who was way before my time, and Billy Fairburn, who was my originally favorite Ranger, who's 43. I know these guys are going to kill me because they got one guy ranked way too high in here that should not be ahead of you. Alex Kovalev at 40. Hell of a hockey player, great player, but as a Ranger, had that great 94 Cup playoff, no doubt about it, but, you know, been here twice. You can't be that great if you, you know, haven't been around a couple of times. So,
if I'm mentioned or included, that's a cherry on the cake. That's an honor right there.
It's great to talk to you. And I guess my last comment, I mean, you got the chance to see Michael Delzato. I was actually at the game at the Garden. You guys played in the Garden. What's your take on Michael Delzato?
I think extremely skilled. I think real good vision and hands. I think we'll see how when you gain a little experience, how he grows. I think it's a tough position to play, and even a lot of young D who have a good first year, they have a tough one their second year. But you know, you see how they play out over the next 3-4 years. I really think he has the skills to be a top offensive defenseman in the league. Because I think he's got the skating, the hands, and the vision. So I do like him. I will say this. Every time I know, and you guys watch him every game, so you see the ups and downs. I think Mark Stahl is a really good defenseman.
I think he's one of the best shutdown defensemen in the league.
He is an elite defenseman, and I think he's the guy who can. He has got a great gap. He can use the body to separate the man from the puck, and then he's got a great stick. When I watch his habits, he makes that quick, simple play. But you know, defending stick on stick and take away the passing lanes. And so I watch him a lot, and I don't see him. It's funny when we're playing them, I'm watching our team. But when I pre-scout or watch them play someone else and I start focusing on him, I think he has as good a habit as almost any two-way defenseman in the league. And I know he thinks defense first, but he's a good skater who can join the rush. And I think he had a pretty good year offensively. But I like him. Boy, I like him as a player.
Yeah.
I think league-wise, he is one of the top two-way defensemen, or he's becoming that. So I like watching him. I like him as a player. I'll say that.
Yeah, I mean, that there's no doubt about it. And he's due for a pay raise this year. And now you guys have the cream of the crop. You got Tyler Myers. I mean, you know, this guy. I mean, you think maybe Tyler's going to hit that wall in a second? Yeah, I hope not for your guys' sake. I mean, he's just a guy that. I mean, the amount of time on ice this guy has played and just a phenomenal. And you know, it's funny because they always want more of the critics. They're like, well, he's just got to learn to play meaner because, you know, he had, 32 minutes in penalty. I'm like, the guy, give it a break. I mean, I can't remember a guy coming in and playing that amount of time and just making such an impact. And I hope he wins the Calder. I really do. I'm really pulling for him.
No, so are we. I hope he doesn't have that tough second year, but with him, like all young players, it's a possibility, and I guess it's our coach as coaches, our responsibility to try all we can to make sure that doesn't happen. But still, they as young players, they have to experience, they have to be in those situations to learn from. So we'll see. I will say this: he's a phenomenal kid, great work ethic, and great attitude. And wants to learn, so it was real fun being around him, and I mean, so polite. Anything he ever said, it was finished with a thank you, and
wow,
he's a strong kid for his size, and he doesn't back down either. Like he's got a physical side to him. I think we'll see that come out more in the next couple of years. But again, like other young players, he's a young player who sometimes wants to hold on to the puck too long or tries to do too much. I think those two things are probably the areas that got him in the most trouble. But on the flip side, great work ethic, real good skater. Boy, when he gets going, he's got a great stride. And for a guy that size, he's got great feet. So, I mean, all of Buffalo is real excited about him. So.
I was at the Ranger game. There was a lot of Sabre fans representing, and a lot of Tyler Myers and a lot of Ryan Miller.
Ryan Miller.
Yeah, that's your boy. And hey, listen, I was amazed, seeing him on TV during the NBC game, I think it was. And how, I don't want to say they use the word slight, but he's kind of a skinny dude.
He is.
I don't know. I guess in today's age where everybody's kind of wide and the whole thing like that, I didn't realize he was that slight of a guy, but holy cow, I tell you, he had all of America rooting for him. And a hell of
He is so technically good. He probably once every about 2 months, he needs like 2 or 3 days to just get his technical skills right back, get him back to where he needs to be in that bank. And then he plays at such a high level for the next 6 weeks. And like every goalie has their ups and downs. But the boy, he's got the physical skills. He's got, good vision and great feet. But technically, he plays so well, I think, with his, his movement across the net and his feet he's a great skater. And I think that's, plays a good gap, but can move with the skaters as they're coming in. So, the Rangers have one of the top goalies as well. So,
Henrik, forget it. They're on the
floor. But every team has their top players, and, we're saying Ryan Miller here and Tyler Myers, are going to be.
What about this Tyler Ennis kid? He came healthy in the season and in the playoffs.
This phenomenal kid who's, when we drafted him, the same draft as Tyler Myers. We had 2 first-round picks. And it was one of those ones where, God, are we taking another small forward? But our scouts loved him so much. And, the kid plays big. And if they're small players and they got heart, you take them. If you look at Callahan with you guys, look at Gionta, look at Camilleri. There's a lot of small players, Kane, who are up there in the scoring in the playoffs. You look at the top 10 scorers, there's a lot of small guys. So he is that type of player with that type of drive. I think he has a lot of the same skills as Pat Kane. He played 10 games for us at the end of the year. I think he finished with 9 points and then played well in the playoffs. Got 3 or 4 points, I think, in the playoffs. So I expect him to be on the team next year.
Yeah.
So
I'm telling you, things are looking up for the Sabres, or the Sabres, as we used to say back in the day, the Buffalo Sabres. And, James, I got to tell you, man, I love talking puck with you. With almost 2 hours, me, you, and Jim, and we covered everything from Keenan to Milo Horshava to
and Milo Horshava doesn't get many mentions is on this show either.
No. Well, next time we do it, we'll have to cover Mark Pavlich and Rayo Ruotsalainen and Mike Allison.
Oh, yeah.
And Tommy Laidlaw and a lot of great stories. Anders Hedberg.
Anders was fantastic.
A lot more stories are.
Yeah, we got to do that because I felt like we still got more to talk about. Mark Pavlich, you're talking about that, the quote-unquote Smurf team. Offensively, one of the better Ranger teams ever assembled, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah,
Rayo was fantastic.
Maybe the best skater I ever played with, the most beautiful stride.
He was fantastic. I actually made contact with him. I'm going to try to get him on the show. So maybe I'll have you a surprise guest, Rayo. He signed his emails Rexy, which I like, too. He's still going by Rexy.
Oh, he does. Good.
So, James, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been great.
Okay, Eddie and Jim, thanks for having me. And again, I look back at my best years of being a Ranger and the best time I had playing hockey and loved it there and loved playing in that city. So it was fun for me and we'll do it again.
Yes. Do you still get chills when you see the uniform, like when you're at the guard?
It definitely holds, it holds special memories. I like the dark blue uniforms for some reason, the blues. I like the away uniform. They're the home uniforms now, but they were away when I played.
Right.
So I've always liked the Ranger pants. They're unique. So.
Supposedly, James, the Rangers are bringing back the New York jerseys that you wore. That's the rumor, anyway.
All right, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, the one, it says New York across. That's cool.
Yeah.
I like that.
I know. I think that'll be neat. So.
All right, James. Thank you so much. The great James. No,
my pleasure, Eddie and Jim. You guys take care.
Take care,
thanks,
my
James.
Friend.
Okay. Okay, goodbye. Thanks.
Bye.
Wow, Jimmy. I'm sorry I couldn't let
great.
You do the podcast thing, you know, letting everybody know, but this was a fantastic guy, and just, come on. I mean, he was so absolutely gracious and giving, and just great.
Funny. Yeah, he was very, very good. You know, if you're going to call him to follow up, you know, just whatever, by all means, just go ahead and book him again for, you know, for July or August if he wants to come, you
yeah.
know, before he starts getting busy again. By all means, everybody in the chat room loved him, and, you know, like you said, there's a million things we didn't touch on, so.
Yeah. He even suggested, well, we could talk about Rayo and Pavlich. And,
right, yeah.
Yeah, so that just shows you what type of guy this guy is. And
yeah.
He deserves to be number 44 in the all-time greats. Actually, deserves to be number 40 because Kovalev doesn't deserve it. Sorry, Adam and Russ. But, the great James Patrick. If Kovalev does his show, hey, maybe I change my tune. But right now, I got Tim Pennington at number 40.
So should we come back and do a show tomorrow night to talk about all the things we didn't talk about tonight?
that's funny. Yeah, I know. I wanted to talk more about the players he played. He just played in 11 years. He played with so many players, especially those ridiculous regimes he played for.
Yeah.
You know, such turnover.
You know what I thought was funny? Did you notice how measured he was when he spoke about Ted Sater? I mean, he was really, really trying very hard to be very diplomatic. His words were, when you go back, I don't know if you noticed it because you were conversating with him at the time, but when you go back and listen to it, I mean, he was very, very careful about what he said.
Yeah, you know, maybe the fear of Ted Sater is still out there. I don't know, but
maybe James has a trip to Hungary planned. He doesn't want to run into him.
He's worried about it. Running into the man Hungarian Ted Sater out there coaching in Hungary. I get it now. I get it why there is a lot of tension still to this day, or bitterness from some of the Rangers towards Ted Sater, because basically he took the heart and soul of the guys, the veteran core, and said, guess what? You're out.
You right.
Know, Kotze's kind of alluded to this, and you know he's good friends with Pierre LaRouche. He was the best man at his wedding. You have Greschner, who he's close with. All these guys were affected by Sater's, you know, nonsense at the beginning of the season.
Yeah.
So there you go. I thought it was great, and hopefully James will be back on again. I think he will. I think he had fun.
Oh, yeah, I think he did, too. So, all right.
All right. Well, everybody take care. And, Jim, maybe I'll see you Friday night on the small show.
I wouldn't miss it. I'll be there.
Okay.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right. Take care, everybody. Good night.
Good night, everybody.